live from the Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York. This is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, with winter's cold setting in, millions of low-income New Yorkers face heating bills they may not be able to pay. Yet the federal funding is still stuck in limbo after the 43-day shutdown. State officials say it could be November 24th or later before help arrives. We'll get an update on the local front about how officials are gearing up to try to deploy HEAP and food assistance benefits. Town of Highland calls its new budget nimble, but can it withstand a 9% county tax hike and a major assessment showdown? Liam Mayo from the River Reporter joins us with the story, plus science stories with Joe Johnson and actor and musician Thomas Waits. You might know him from iconic films like The Warriors and The Thing. We'll learn more after the news from NPR.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Several women who've accused late sex offender Jeffrey Epstein of sexual abuse have gathered on Capitol Hill. They're speaking out ahead of a planned vote by the House that requires that the Justice Department release all files linked to Epstein. President Trump had tried to block the measure, but did an about-face this week. He told Republican lawmakers in the House and the Senate to support it. The effort in the House is co-sponsored by Republican Congressman Thomas Massie. He says if Republican senators want to change the House bill in any way, they need to focus on releasing the information.
If you want to add some additional protections for these survivors, go for it. But if you do anything that prevents any disclosure, you are not for the people and you are not part of this effort. Do not muck it up in the Senate.
The women say they are forming a group to demand action to protect women and children against sexual abuse. The House is set to vote today on a bipartisan bill to restore collective bargaining rights for most federal workers. NPR's Andrea Hsu reports a majority of House lawmakers signed a petition to force a vote.
The bill was first introduced by Democratic Congressman Jared Golden of Maine in April after President Trump issued an executive order terminating collective bargaining rights for roughly 1 million federal workers, citing national security concerns. The bill, called the Protect America's Workforce Act, would nullify that executive order. On Monday, two Republicans signed on to a discharge petition, reaching the necessary threshold to force a vote. One of them, Congressman Mike Lawler of New York, said in a statement, "Every American deserves the right to have a voice in the workplace." Despite multiple lawsuits challenging Trump's executive order, some federal agencies have already canceled collective bargaining agreements, while others are simply ignoring them. Andrea Hsu, NPR News.
The One Big Beautiful Bill passed by Congress included a provision designed to defund Planned Parenthood. This was done by cutting it out of Medicaid. As NPR's Selena Simmons Duffin reports, the law also affects a network of sexual health clinics in Maine, where abortion is legal.
Medicaid already does not pay for abortions in Maine or anywhere else in the country. Now, Maine Family Planning's network of 18 clinics cannot bill Medicaid for any services, including fertility treatment, birth control, sexually transmitted infection treatment, primary care, and more. Vanessa Shields-Haas, the nurse practitioner at the Thomaston Clinic, says half of Maine Family Planning's patients are on Medicaid.
We've been seeing all of those patients for free. We haven't been turning them away.
That has meant a 20% cut to Maine Family Planning's annual budget, and three clinics have had to end their primary care services. Selena Simmons-Duffin, NPR News, Thomaston, Maine.
On Wall Street, the Dow is down more than 500 points, or down more than 1%. The NASDAQ is down nearly 2%. This is NPR. An infrastructure provider for internet services says it's resolved problems. Cloudflare reported that it detected an unusual spike in traffic today. The problem led to service interruptions with online platforms such as Spotify, ChatGPT, and others. Cloudflare says it's watching now to make sure everything gets back to normal. A federal judge has decided not to sentence a former Alaska Airlines pilot to prison. Joseph Emerson had pleaded guilty to trying to turn off the engines of a passenger jet in flight over Oregon. The plane landed safely. Emerson says he wanted to take responsibility for his actions. There's new research into ant colonies and why some ants can kill their queen. NPR's Nell Greenfield Boyce explains.
It's hard for a young would-be queen ant to strike out on her own and try to establish a brand new colony. So some ant species have evolved a way for female ants to basically take over existing colonies of another species. In the journal Current Biology, researchers in Japan describe how a female ant will sneak into a colony, creep up to its queen, and spray a chemical onto her. This chemical has a dramatic effect. It makes the colony's worker ants suddenly turn on their queen, who is also their mother. The workers unwittingly betray her, attacking her until she's dead. Then the female intruder becomes the new queen and uses the workers to raise her own offspring. Nell Greenfield Boyce, NPR News.
You're listening to NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Imaginable Futures, funding programs in the U.S. with the goal of ensuring young children and their parents get the education they need to thrive. Learn more at imaginablefutures.com. This is NPR.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for joining us. With the end of the federal government shutdown, November SNAP benefits are back, providing food assistance to low-income families. But the resumption of the benefit program doesn't eliminate food insecurity altogether. And as the cold sets in, some local residents are waiting on federal aid to heat their homes as well. Patricio Rubio spoke with Sullivan County's Health and Human Services Commissioner John Little about the status of HEAP and SNAP benefits and what folks can expect this winter.
I first want to start off, you know, where things stand today. Can you give us a quick update on SNAP now that the federal government has reopened, and what should residents know right now?
Yeah, so now that the federal government's reopened, SNAP is operating close to normal. I only say close to normal because the payment timelines were pushed back because of the shutdown. What we saw in New York was payments started going out on the 9th. Normally, that's a 10-day process at the beginning of the month. So what we're advising clients now is if they don't receive their full November benefits by the 19th, that they should definitely let us know so that we can help them with that. But we expect that everything is now running smooth.
Something I've been seeing on social media is that now that the federal government is open, that folks on SNAP would have to reapply for SNAP. Is that true?
So not because of the shutdown, but there are more work requirements coming in, things that were changed by way of the Big Beautiful Bill. So it's important for folks to know that recertification requirements are going to they're going to be seeing them more quickly than they used to. But there is nothing specifically attributable to the federal shutdown that changes recertification. So if you were certified before the federal government shut down and you weren't due for a recertification, you don't have to, you shouldn't expect another recertification to come up.
And for residents who get SNAP at the very beginning of the month, but still haven't, as of now, has seen anything in their account, what should they do? Who should they contact?
Yeah, so again, we think that all benefits should be paid out by the 19th. If anybody doesn't receive their normal benefit by the 19th, they should contact us at Social Services. They can contact their worker directly if they knew who that is, or if you need to call our main switchboard, that's also perfectly fine. That number is 845-292-0100.
Now let's talk about HEAP. The start of the HEAP season has been delayed. Can you just remind folks what caused the delay and where do things stand now?
Yeah, so again, this was delayed because of the federal government shutdown. Now that the federal government shutdown is over, we have the ability to get things started again. We were just advised earlier today by the state of New York that they have not received funds from the federal government yet. That's not anything to be alarmed about. They just haven't appeared in, the transfers haven't all happened yet. We expect that is going to happen within the next few days. And if it does, then we expect the program will open for new applications next week on the 24th, but that's not a confirmed date just yet.
Now, if someone runs into a heating emergency before HEAP has officially opened and things are, you know, back to normal, semi-normal again, is there any help available for them now through social services?
There is. So folks can come in, talk to us, give us a call at the number I gave. You can go to My Benefits, the New York State website. The guidance that we're giving folks is there are public assistance opportunities. Public assistance benefits tend to be stricter in terms of their eligibility. So just because you're eligible for HEAP doesn't mean that you'll be eligible necessarily for public assistance, but it's something that we're happy to look into with folks if they feel like they're in some sort of emergency right now. And then on top of it all, if someone is in a really tough state, the warming centers are going to open for the season this Friday night. They'll be open from 8 p.m. to 8 a.m., seven nights a week. And those locations will be at the Liberty United Methodist Church on Main Street in Liberty and St. John's Episcopal in on St. John Street in Monticello.
And those are not overnight. There's a time limit, right? A certain time you can come in, a certain time you have to leave.
Yeah, correct. They're not full shelters. They're not certified as shelters, so they don't operate on a 24-hour basis. We operate them overnight. And as I said, they'll be open from 8 p.m. to 8 a.m. seven nights a week throughout the season.
Now, continuing on the shutdown, you know, food insecurity, I should say, has spiked during the shutdown. What are you hearing from the local food pantries and partners, and how are you working with them post-government reopening?
Yeah, so our sense was that we were going to be okay for the month of November because the food pantries were already deep in their preparations for Thanksgiving. So there's always a lot that comes together to support families over the Thanksgiving holiday. So we felt pretty good about where we were at there. The concerns we were getting from folks coming into social services directly to our window was really more on the HEAP side than on the SNAP side. Concerns did percolate up about SNAP, you know, as we went days and days into the shutdown. But now that we're out of that scenario, feels like we're okay. And that was the impression that we got from the community providers, was that if the shutdown lasted into December, we were going to have some really dangerous problems. But because we haven't, because it was resolved before then, we certainly continue to be concerned about food insecurity and, you know, funding for our food pantries over the long term. But for the foreseeable future, we seem to be in good shape.
My thoughts over the weekend, knowing that this interview was going to come up today, I really thought about, you know, how fragile the safety net can be, you know, and I just was wondering if there are any lessons to be learned from the shutdown this past couple of weeks and how Sullivan County can prepare for disruptions in federal programs.
Well, I feel really good about where we were at, actually, because I think, it's one of the reasons that I moved here 6 years ago and that I love to live here, is there's a certain spirit about this community that comes together more than most, certainly other rural communities that I've lived in my life and, you know, in my travels around the country as I was a military vet. but yeah, it's certainly, you know, there are some things that no matter what we do at the county level and even at the state level that we can't pay on our own, that the full resources of the federal government are needed. And really, when I think about that, I'm thinking about health insurance and how folks are going to be able to get medical health care going forward, because gaps in the Medicaid system created by changes in federal policy are so big that they really can't be, at least the ones that have come through the Big Beautiful Bill, they're not things that we at the state or local level can really compensate for. So that's my biggest concern going forward, is access to health care. But certainly these other social safety net programs, aside from Medicare or Medicaid, it certainly bears looking after, because, you know, I think we have some dark days ahead in the economy that we have to be prepared for.
You know, finally, John, I just want to see if there's any message to families listening right now who are worried about food, heat, or making it through the next couple of weeks of winter and fall.
Well, my message to people is I think always the same, is please give us a chance in government and amongst our United Sullivan partner agencies that work together. There's a lot more available to folks in Sullivan County than they probably think. Yeah, there are certain things like specialty care for healthcare, since I'm talking about healthcare so much. You know, specialty care is definitely a challenge for us, and a lot of folks have to go out of county for that. But we have good resources for mental health, for the social safety net, food insecurity. You know, those providers are out there, and we have the technology tools to link everybody together. And you know, we work really hard at DSS to cut the red tape for folks so that they can get access to what they're entitled to as quick as possible. These are government programs, so there is definitely red tape to get cut through, but we try our best to get folks that access. So we don't want folks to kind of give up just because it sounds like the system is tough or it's not in their favor right now. We still want to help people as much as we can, so we encourage them to try and communicate with us, and hopefully we can help a lot of folks.
We were talking to John Little, Commissioner of Health and Human Services in Sullivan County, giving us an update on SNAP and HEAP benefits. Again, John, thank you so much for talking to us, not only today, for the past couple of weeks during the shutdown. Your information, I think, has been fantastic for our listeners, and we brought a lot of value to our listeners. So thank you so much for that.
Yeah, always good to be with you. Thanks for the opportunity.
In Liberty, I'm Patricio Robayo for Radio Catskill.
You can find a full list of resources for food in our area at our website, wjffradio.org. Also, a little bit more on those heating assistance funds. New York State officials say the Trump administration should release HEAP funds that are still in limbo after the 43-day shutdown. From the New York Public News Network, WNYC's Jimmy Vielkind reports.
Governor Kathy Hochul says the federal government shutdown delayed the release of home heating assistance. The shutdown disrupted the application window for the Low-Income Home Energy Assistance Program, or LIHEAP, which helps more than a million households in the state. Hochul says the state is waiting for $400 million. The state administers the program with federal funds. The governor says the delay is frustrating.
What are you waiting for? Why isn't this released? But this is the month when people are already expected to enroll.
The Federal Department of Health and Human Services has said it will work, quote, swiftly to send awards now that the 43-day shutdown is over. In Albany, I'm Jimmy Vielkind for the New York Public News Network.
We'll take a break, and when we come back, the town of Highland's 2026 budget looks calm on paper, but some big battles over taxes and pipelines brewing underneath. Reporter Leah Mayo from The River Reporter joins us next. This is Radio Chatskill.
I'm Maria Hinojosa, this week on Latino USA. The star of the HBO It Show of the Moment, Task, Raul Castillo, joins me for guacamole and totopos.
I just need to add some, and then you're going to give me the taste test.
Yes.
And you have to just be honest.
Amazing.
That's this week on Latino USA. Thursday afternoon at 2 on Radio Catskill.
Radio Catskill's annual music sale is the Saturday after Thanksgiving, and we need donations of high-quality vinyl records. We're looking for clean discs that have been cared for, collectible LPs in sought-after genres, rock, jazz, hip-hop, heavy metal, dance, even rare and valuable records. If you are a collector who's looking to downsize, give new collectors something good to take home. Email feedback at wjffradio.org and support Radio Catskill with your donation of high-quality vinyl today.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. The town of Highland in Sullivan County is moving what it calls a nimble spending plan for 2026, a budget that doesn't change much on the surface, but sits on top of several big questions about the town's financial future. In the latest article in The River Reporter, journalist and news editor Liam Mayo breaks it all down about what the proposed budget means, and he joins us now to walk us through what he found. Liam, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Tim.
Now, this is a roughly $3.58 million budget for the town of Highland that's been proposed. They're calling it a nimble budget, as you say in your headline as well. What does it mean that it's nimble? What do they mean by that?
Yeah, town supervisor John Pizzolatto introduced the budget at a budget hearing last week, and he used that word nimble a couple of times. And part of what he was telling about the budget was that they were trying to keep it a little bit conservative, thinking about a couple of the things you mentioned that could be happening in the future. So two of the things he emphasized were county-level things. He talked about how the town tried to keep its budget on the conservative side, reacting to the county's own tax increase. Sullivan County has proposed a 9.1% tax increase for its next year's budget. Highland proposed about a 3.73% tax increase. And Pizzolatto said that the county's proposed tax hike, quote, is nothing we can do anything about. If the county comes in and usurps our town's tax base and our taxes, we've tried to respond and keep everything down. So it was a factor in the mind of the town as it made this budget that there is this other burden that is coming onto taxpayers, and that's something where they tried to respond, they were saying, by not putting their own burden on taxpayers. Lotto also said that the town is going to try and advocate against the 9.1% tax increase, or try and find some way to alleviate that a little bit or mitigate that. But he wanted sort of to put out the message that the town itself is trying to keep things minimal to react to that.
Yeah, that looks like it's going to be something that a lot of towns in the county are facing as the proposed budget in the county is hiking, planning to hike some taxes. And so they're trying to stay nimble, as the town supervisor says, in face of these looming financial uncertainties, taking a conservative view. A conservative view of revenues the town could collect, including potential taxes from property owned by Millennium Pipeline. That's the company that operates that pipeline running through much of Sullivan County. Talk a little bit more about that and how it impacts the thinking of their budgeting in the town of Highland.
Yeah, Millennium Pipeline, as you mentioned, owns property under its pipeline or with its pipeline all across Sullivan County. Across a couple of different towns, and it currently has had a payment in lieu of taxes agreement where, under the terms of that agreement, it's paying less than the like contemporary assessed value of tax on those parcels. So that pilot agreement is about to end, which means its tax revenue should jump as it starts paying the currently assessed rate on the parcels it owns. And that's something that Pizzolatto said isn't actually factored into the budget yet. I mean, he said that part of the reason for that was the town's assessor was on vacation, so he wasn't sure, so that they couldn't calculate those numbers. But then also part of the reason, or part of the thing that will be thought about by towns across the county, is there is the possibility for Millennium to challenge those assessments as it starts needing to pay more, or it has the opportunity to petition the towns to reduce its assessments to try and get out of paying that sort of full amount of taxes. We had some reporting earlier in October out of the town of Tustin, where the town is going to be working with the county and the other towns around to try and join forces and advocate for Millennium to pay its full fair share of taxes during that assessment process. We confirmed with County Director of Communications Dan Heath that the county is going to be working with towns and school districts to do that. Back in Highland, Pizzolatto sort of was advocating for the similar thing, where he said that, quote, "We've spoken to the assessor at great length about tax the hell out of them, because this is a pipeline that goes through the town without necessarily contributing in a significant way to the economic health of the town, the way like a business that operates in the town and brings tourists in necessarily would." So that's something that isn't necessarily factored into Highland's budget right now that could be a major financial windfall, or a bump in the finances of the town. But there's also this uncertainty about whether, how much that's going to be and when that's going to be. So that's just not something that was factored into the budget.
And let's talk about how the public comment period at the budget meeting, how that sort of offered a glimpse in how the election most recently, the November 4th election, may have changed or not changed the political landscape in Highland. As we've reported previously, the town of Highland has a volatile political landscape, I would say. But let's talk a little bit about what you saw and heard at the public comment period during the meeting.
Yeah, so as we've talked about before, And as happened in this most recent election, the current town supervisor, John Tizzolatto, was challenged by Mel Carney. Mel fell short in the election, and Pizzolatto won re-election. So the status quo is kind of the same. However, I think the reason this kind of ties into the budget process is one of Mel's significant arguments on the campaign trail was that things weren't being done properly with the finances of the town. She had a sort of handout she was going around with, talking about and sort of specifying different points of things that she, in her opinion, should have been done in a certain way when it comes to the town's budget or its grant applications or similar things like that. So at this public comment period, at this budget hearing, Carney was there and she made some of the same comments she's made before, and it kind of devolved into a shouting match between her and the town supervisor. And it ended up getting gaveled down from the board with Supervisor Pizzolatto saying, let me just pull out my notes real quick. Your disinformation will not be tolerated from here on out. If you want to continue on this trajectory, then you will be asked to leave. So it's, at least from that one immediate meeting, the political forces that made this past election a contentious one in Highland are going to continue even past sort of an electoral defeat or electoral situation that showed a majority of voters in the town support what Pizzolatto is doing. But it's just, I think I'll be interested to see whether that continues as it has been or whether there ends up being any change or lessening in the tensions as the election kind of sinks in a little bit.
Still volatile, I would say. There also came up, there was also a review of the town clerk's office we talked about back in August. That came up in this meeting as well. Let's remind folks about what that review was and how there were some missing funds or misidentified funds.
Yeah, there was a review of the town clerk's office from this outside group, identifying a couple of discrepancies in the town's accounts. Sort of the big flashy one is a, quote, total variance of just under $5.4 million between the deposits made into the clerk bank accounts versus transactions logged in the various systems. So the report identified around over $5 million in money in the town's accounts that couldn't be accounted for. So at that budget hearing, a couple of town officials talked about some of the processes they're going through to try and a little bit recreate that paper trail, and also just a little bit put processes into place to make sure that there is a paper trail going forward. They mentioned that the town is working to improve its processes and sort of better identify how money is coming in and better track how money is coming in so that it can be identified in the future. And they mentioned that some of that $5 million that can't be logged may be sort of money that came into the town for permits and other fees that just wasn't logged properly. So they mentioned that they're working to improve those processes, including by establishing a new sort of bank account, especially for the code clerk, so that goes through its own channel, and identifying the different types of permits that are going into the system. So I think there's still the other side of the finances argument that came up in the political process was Pizzolatto saying that previous administrations and sort of the way things had been done was improper, and it's stuff that he's and the rest of the town board is still sort of fixing and still figuring out from stuff that happened before they took office.
Always lots happening at our town board meetings. The proposed $3.58 million budget for 2026 in the town of Highland, what's next for that? Is there a vote coming up in the next meeting?
I believe so, yeah.
Okay. That's Liam Mayo. He'll stay on it, and we'll report back when we talk to you the next time. It's Liam Mayo from the River Reporter, his reporting, and the team's reporting at riverreporter.com. Liam, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
We'll take a break, and when we come back, we'll talk about some science stories with our resident science guy, Joe Johnson, from bumblebees that can tell time, to a newly discovered hoofed dinosaur and an clever strategy that could help you win at, get this, rock, paper, scissors. That's coming up next. This is Radio Chatskill.
The Radio Catskill Music Auction is live online. Bid on rare collectible vinyl records like the infamous Beatles Butcher cover, a holy grail for record collectors, Profile by Duke Pearson on the Blue Note Jazz label, and music from Big Pink. The band wrote it in the Catskills. You can buy it to support Radio Catskill. Don't miss your chance to get your hands on all of our incredible items and experiences. Bid on the music auction at WJFFradio.org. The Radio Catskill Music Auction is live online. Bid now on vintage stereo equipment like turntables by Bang & Olufsen, Yamaha, and Duel, a Denon stereo receiver, cassette decks from Kenwood and Harman Kardon, classic items tested, working, and ready to play your music. Don't miss your chance to get your hands on all of our incredible items and experiences. Bid on the Radio Catskill Music Auction now at WJFFradio.org.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Well, bumblebees that can tell time, a dinosaur with hooves, and a sneaky trick to win at rock, paper, scissors. It's all a part of Science Stories with Joe Johnson this week. He spoke to Jason Dole to explain the science behind the headlines.
Our first story comes from the October 23rd issue of Science magazine. Story starts around 66 million years ago when a small herd of duck-billed dinosaurs, specifically Edmontosaurus annectens, they perished, and apparently in a drought. Now, there's evidence that the bodies then lay in the sun for a week or so, and we know that because of what happened next. Ironically, they were buried in a flood. And we know this because the bodies are encased in fine clay mixed with broken branches and rock. That's indicative of a flood. So they died of a drought, but then they were buried in a flood. Now, this preserved an impression of the skin as it lay draped on their bones. And that's how we know that they were in a drought, because they could actually see the shape of the skin, and they could see that it was like hanging on the bones. And they've been called fossil mummies, even though there's no organic material left. Because of the way they were buried, it left a perfect impression of the body itself.
And I guess then they're getting that nickname because most people, and most commonly, you know, with large dinosaurs, you're looking at the fossils of the bones, right? Maybe an impression of some skin. So this is like something giving you a really good visual idea of what the body might have been
right.
Like.
Exactly. Now, it had been changed, if you will, by laying out in the sun and starting to decompose. But there's amazing detail of the texture of the skin and other surface features. Now, starting in 1908, paleontologists found a couple of these mummies. Unfortunately, the scientists of the day did not have access to the technology that we have today. They did note that there was an impression of the skin, and they did look at the bones, but that's about as far as they could get. Now, recently, two new mummies have been discovered. They thought, you know, hey, there were two of these. Let's go see if there's more. And they found a 20-foot-long juvenile and a 40-foot-long adult, all right? And they were then examined using X-rays and CAT scans. And what they found, this is the interesting part. Yes, it's interesting how they died and were buried. But they found that the rear feet had three large toes, each capped with a hoof, very similar to that of a horse. Now, this is the first, and by the way, the front feet were discovered to have a single, like, central hoof-like structure, they called it. This is the first hoof ever known on a reptile. Yes, the three toes, but it's the first hoof, and it's the earliest known example of a hoof on any type of animal. They beat the ungulates, the modern hoofed animals that we know, like, you know, horses and things like that, by a couple of million years. And so the question is, for me at least, how did these two different lines of animals, you know, dinosaurs and mammals, evolve the same structure? You know, mammals and reptiles diverged over 300 million years ago in the evolutionary tree. And so how did they get the same thing? I think this is an example of what they call convergent evolution, where different animals or different plants solve the same problem in the same way. birds and bats each developing wings. Arctic and Antarctic fish can both be frozen and then come back to life because they have an antifreeze in their blood, but the blood is coded for by different genes in the different fish in the Antarctic and Arctic. So they develop them, independently of each other. A lot of plants have developed spikes. And so, you know, this is convergent evolution, I think. This is pretty cool.
And probably the most common one that listener, you may have even seen memes about is, you know, how many different times nature tried to come up with a crab. That's another thing you see a lot out there online.
Yes, yes.
It's just a shape and a form that nature kind of keeps coming back to at different periods of evolution in different places in the world.
If it works. Now, you got to remember that both the horse and these duck-billed dinosaurs were herbivores that had to run to avoid predators. And so it kind of makes sense that they would evolve the same structure.
You know, the funny thing is when you start describing it, and then I'm looking at the pictures here, I feel like I've seen depictions of similar duck-billed dinosaurs with those prominent toes. Maybe even like seeing them. Did anybody think that they might have been hoofs before this, but they weren't able to prove this? Or is this like totally coming out of nowhere?
This is the only time that an impression of the foot has been preserved. You know, normally they're going to get the bones, and the bones aren't going to show that there was a hoof there. They're just going to show that there were bones there. So I don't know the answer to that question totally, but that's kind of what I guess. There are a lot of other duck-billed dinosaurs. This isn't the only species of them around.
Right.
So it'll be interesting to see if what they find in the future.
Yeah, and they might start cross-referencing with other species and other fossil finds around there. And I just want to go back to the beginning of the story, though, and just think that it's just amazing that fossils can give us a snapshot of time down to like the week or month, and that can tell a story that we can relate to today.
Sure.
A place where there's a drought, and then when the rain does come, there's flash flooding. Like we've seen that around us, and absolutely, that was happening millions of years ago right here on the same planet.
The area is about 10 kilometers across, and they actually call it the mummy zone. They have found other dinosaurs before there, but I don't believe any of them were mummified like these duck-billed dinosaurs were.
Moving on to other news stories, I like hearing about our fuzzy friends who are not animals, but insects, the bees.
The bees, yeah.
And it seems like the bees are always advancing on us and learning new things all the time. And speaking of time, they're learning to tell time?
They're learning to tell time, or they have the ability to, yeah. This was an experiment carried out at Queen Mary University in London. A PhD candidate, a guy named Alex Davidson, and his supervisor, they designed an experiment that showed that bumblebees can process the duration of a light pulse and associate this with a preferred food source. The bumblebee in question is called Bombus terrestris. It's native to Europe and North Africa, and it's also called the buff-tailed bumblebee. It looks like it has a little powder puff on its tail. It's kind of cute. So what the scientists did was they built a maze with a connecting corridor between the nest, the bee nest box, and an experimental chamber. Now, in this chamber, there was a preferred food source, which was a sucrose solution, sugar solution, and a bitter quinine solution as well. Behind each source was a flashing yellow circle, and the duration of the flashes were associated with the reward and the bitter alternative. Now, they trained 10 bees to associate the positive reward with a longer duration flash. In other words, they took these 10 bees, they showed them the sucrose and the quinine, they showed them the long flash behind the sucrose and the short flash behind the quinine, and they very quickly learned that the longer flash indicated that that was the good stuff for them, that was the sucrose. Then they took 10 bees and they did the opposite, they took 10 different bees, and they were trained to associate the positive reward with a shorter duration flash, and once again, they very quickly learned percentage of performance that they could figure out which one had the sucrose and remember which one had the sucrose pretty quickly.
So that's an interesting skill in and of itself in the context of that specific experiment, but that seems to point to a larger skill set that these bees have. This is indicating some abilities that they've got that we're just starting to identify there.
Right, right. Well, the question, though, is this. You know, things evolve different capabilities for different reasons. So what's the evolutionary advantage of this? Why would they have this ability to be able to discern? And some of the flashes were as short as a half a second. So they can discern down to a half a second. Why would this be an advantage to them? You know, nowhere in the natural environment would this be of use to them. Flowers don't flash on and off. So why would this happen? Now, the two arguments. One is that maybe the bee brain is just complex enough. It's got about 700 or 800,000 neurons in it. And so maybe it's just complex enough to be able to do this. Or one of the other arguments, one of the things that Alex Davidson said was perhaps that evolved for different purposes, such as keeping track of movement in space or communication. So why would they need to do this?
And I guess that's what, in my own inept way, I was trying to ask that. I was just saying, like, boy, this looks like it's pointing to some other untapped skill set that we might not know how to place. Of course, when you talk about, like, flashes of light in the natural world, I am thinking it brings to mind for me, like, patterns cast by foliage on sunny days. Things mm-hmm. like if you're traveling past items with the sun behind it, but that's getting a little specific. Well,
I thought you were going to mention lightning bugs, because that's what came to thought for me, because lightning bugs, different species have different patterns of flashing, which they actually use to identify each other for the purposes of reproduction. And so they can, apparently the lightning bugs can do this too. So I would imagine there's going to be some more research going on here, you know, like how fine what fraction of a second can they figure out or can they discern? So I see some more research coming down the line here.
And what's the name of this bee again?
Bombus terrestris.
And
the buff-tailed bumblebee.
Buff-tailed bumblebee. I mean, because, you know, we've got the bald eagle. This is kind of like this bee's bald on the other end. It's got like a white... whitish rear end.
Yeah, it does. It's cute little bumblebee.
And then you're bringing up lightning bugs. Mm-hmm. It's just a coincidence, but I will say these have a slightly brighter rear end than other bees.
Perhaps there's a connection.
Let's get into some actual science, though, just Jason's speculation.
Well, this third story here, rock, paper, scissors story, this was from the September 30th issue. This was a pre-publication paper in the Journal of Social, Cognitive, and Effective Neuroscience, which I had never seen before. And it's an article on the playing of rock, paper, scissors. And we've all played rock, paper, scissors, you know, to decide social question, who goes first, who's going to leave the tip. Et cetera, et cetera.
And people do it in lots of different cultures around the world. Even folks that don't speak English will do a similar thing. Yeah.
Right. You don't need any language for it. So it's a simple game. Yeah. So these scientists use 62 individuals, 31 pairs of people, playing a computerized version of rock, paper, scissors while hooked up to EEGs. And so they could see what was going on in their brain. And they played a total of 15,000 games. And this is where the paper kind of went off the rails for me when I was reading it, because they really didn't get into what the brain was doing. Most of the analysis seems to be focused on the randomness of the choices versus how many games the individual won. And that's not what I was looking for in the paper. And their conclusions were that a totally random choice was the best strategy, but that humans have a real problem being random. Okay, most of the participants showed distinct biases either for or against a certain choice. And for example, many people choose rock as their first choice, and a large number of times. And some players will never choose or very rarely choose paper. And they also said that most of the participants were influenced by the results of the last round and made a next round choice based on what happened. And they're saying that that you should be totally random. And I didn't buy that. I'm sorry. I think in a game like this, you've got to have a little strategy. So I looked around and I found another paper. This was from 2014, I think, and it was a study from China. They used 360 students playing 300 rounds, and this study suggests something very different. They say that winners will tend to repeat their winning choice. So if you play rock and you come up against somebody who plays scissors, you win, and in the next round, chances are you may play rock again, and so the person thinking that or knowing that can choose either scissors or paper. You know, scissors, blunts, or paper or rock.
Wow!
To defeat their next rock choice.
And that makes me wonder, though, if the people who wrote that other paper, when they're talking about people's biases towards certain one, maybe they noticed the same thing, but just described it as a bias to a certain one without looking at or attaching that increased use of something to correlate it with the wins.
The first paper, I have to say, was very confusing paper to read. It's very confusing. The other thing, back to the second paper, though, is they said that losers tend to change their choice. So if you play paper and the other person plays scissors, You know, next round you should play rock or scissors because they're probably going to play scissors again. And so there is some strategy there, but I had high hopes for this article when I wrote it, and I was a little disappointed in how kind of thorough it was.
Of course, if you're just doing one, if you're just doing one and done,
that makes
it even harder to make that call. So this is interesting. Do you think there's going to be any further research into this?
I kind of hope not. there probably will. I know it is a popular thing to use in psychology. To understand how people think and understand how people make choices. However, it's just, I don't know. Like I said, the paper was very dissatisfying for me.
Right. Well, I know it can take care of that.
What's that?
Scissors.
Scissors.
Just keep your rock away from the paper. Joe, thank you so much for going over all these science stories.
Always my pleasure.
And thanks to Jason Dole and our own science guy, Joe Johnson. We'll take a break, and when we come back, Thomas Waits, actor, musician, and storyteller whose career has spanned iconic films like The Warriors and The Thing, as well as acclaimed work on stage and in music. We'll learn more when we talk to him next. This is Radio Chatskill.
Next time on the Retro Cocktail Hour, we've got tunes by the Mambo King and the Tokyo Panorama Mambo Boys, plus something new by Mr. Moai and the Tiki Heads. I'm Daryl Brogdon. Join me where the music's always shaken, not stirred. The Retro Cocktail Hour. Wednesday night at 7, here on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thomas Waits first made his mark as a young actor in cult classics like The Warriors and John Carpenter's The Thing, earning recognition for his intensity and presence on screen. He's a Juilliard-trained actor and earned an MFA in playwriting from the University of Iowa, and he's built a versatile career spanning Broadway, off-Broadway, theater, television, independent films, and teaching, founding his own acting studio in New York City. And on top of all that, he's also a singer, songwriter, blending storytelling, social commentary, and Americana influences into his music. His band Heartbreak Waits delivers folk, rock, and Americana songs that blend stirring protest songs with original material. The Heartbreak Waits are playing The Colony in Woodstock this Thursday, and Thomas Waits joins us now to tell us more. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. Thanks for being here. I want to talk a little bit about your early life here and your, going back to Juilliard even and the playwriting and all of that formal training in both acting and writing. How does that shape the way you craft songs today?
It's a very interesting question. I came from basically down the street from the ghetto outside of Philadelphia, and Shakespeare is what got me out of there and into Juilliard. So you can imagine what a shock it was to my system to go from a lower middle class blue collar family to this extraordinarily high end culture, the elite of culture, which I guess, is all of Lincoln Center with drama, dance, opera. And so that transition was formidable in forming my character from the ages of 18 to, I guess, 21 or 22, I was around I was in the elevator with Rudolf Nureyev, I've witnessed some of the greatest talents. Even Leonard Bernstein taught us a class, So I had really great influences as a young person. And, and then, of course, being a trained actor and doing Shakespeare professionally, and all of that experience sort of registers in your subconscious someplace. When you go to write a song, you don't realize that hopefully you have the capacity to draw from that beautiful and brilliant language to try to tell a story. And never have we needed stories more than we do now.
And you were cast in The Warriors in your early 20s as Fox, later, a few years later, you played Windows in John Carpenter's The Thing. Both of those movies are iconic, casts are iconic, but there were some, intense atmosphere in both of those films. How does that influence you as well and move beyond all of that into just storytelling?
Well, I was very lucky as a kid. By the time I was 23, I signed a 3-picture deal with Paramount. And my first picture was The Warriors with Walter Hill directing. And he and I didn't get along very well because mostly I was a huge pain in the ass. And so he fired me. And this had, talk about an indelible imprint on one's consciousness. This really shocked me. And I realized that, you know, there might be something wrong with me. And, you know, there was something wrong. There was serious, I don't know if you've seen Deliver Me From Nowhere, the Springsteen movie, but, mm-hmm. you know, there were mental issues that I had to address, addiction among one of the most profound issues. And, you know, that was course correcting a trajectory towards stardom, which I managed to derail pretty effectively.
Is that part of why you decided to found your own acting studio to kind of work with actors confronting their own issues or resolving their own crisis?
Absolutely. I've made all the mistakes, so I can help you from making the same mistakes. Because, you know, I think the best teachers teach by example. And so not only do I continue to act, direct, write, teach, make music, make movies, be in movies, but I try to pass on the knowledge and the information, or if you will, the wisdom that I've gained from the damage that I self-engineered in my own life. And, you know, I think that can be useful to people. You know, don't cross that bridge. You know, I'll give you a perfect example. One of my earliest students was Vinny Pastor, right, from Big Pussy from The Sopranos. Mm-hmm. And the year he got the TV show, he called me up. I was living in Iowa at the time. And he's like, you know, would you come out here and coach me? And so I flew back to coach him. And the phone rings and it's David Chase. And David Chase says, you know, look, I have good news and bad news. The good news is I wrote a great scene for you. The bad news is I'm killing off your character this year. And he's like, that, you know, every expletive in the book. I'm going to call him up right now. How dare he do this? And I was like, wait a second. You're not calling anyone. You can tell me how you feel. If you pick up the phone to call him, the only thing you're going to say is, Mr. Chase, thank you so much for the work you've given me. I'm exceedingly grateful to be part of this great show, and it's done wonders for my career, which it did. And so there was an example of how I stepped in, you know, with the experience of the suffering that I created in my own life and was able to be useful and of service to another person and help them go on and have, you know, a terrific career after that. And that's an example of how I can be useful, you know?
Yeah, and you and the band Heartbreak Waits are playing at the Colony in Woodstock this Thursday, as I mentioned. You're including some powerful protest songs alongside some original material. Talk a little bit about your set that's coming up on Thursday and some of the reasons why you want to emphasize some of the protest songs.
I'm so excited. You have no idea. First of all, to play Woodstock. Oh, my God. You know, all of my idols, the band, Bob Dylan, everybody that came through there. It's like, you know, I'm so excited about it. But I'll be specific regarding the protest songs. So the deal is that, you know, anybody that's even partly awake to the fascist takeover that's, you know, fallen upon our country, sadly, 76% of the people that have been put in these detention centers are not guilty of any crime, misdemeanor, not even a DUI, but yet they're being forced to do labor. And this is, forget the Epstein files, which are going to be a joke because they're going to redact all of the horror that's descended upon our country has got to be addressed, okay? So my deal is I'm going to open for my band because they're afraid. I mean, can you believe this? They're afraid. They're scared of being photographed or seen with someone that's singing about the truth of what's going on in America. So I said, it's okay. You know,
Your own band members are afraid of being photographed with you?
Well, one of them, you know, is Canadian and he has to cross the border because his wife has issues or whatever, you know, domestic. He's got to take care of his homes up there. And if they check your phone and they see that you're not a Trump supporter, you know, people have been detained for that. Do you realize that's going on?
So you're channeling your anger through music here, and even if your bandmates, not all of them, are going to be fully supportive, you're going to go out in front and show your feelings, your side.
It's not that they're not supportive. Don't misunderstand me. Yeah. I don't want to jeopardize them. If ICE or Trump or any of those come after me, that's fine. I'm fine with that. Give me liberty or give me death. But I don't want to jeopardize anyone else in the process. You understand?
Yeah. Well, talk about some of the other songs you're going to sing besides the protest songs. Your band has its own sound. You're going to be playing some of your own songs as well, right?
Yeah, we play almost all original songs. Okay. We do a few cover songs. But, you know, a lot of them are love songs. You know,
that's going to be a shift. That'll be kind of a shift from protest to love songs.
Yeah, and it's a great band. And, you know, if I had to get one thing in that's critically important here, is that the main reason that I started this band is to exploit the people that are in it. I mean, I have a kid that plays keyboard in Cajon named Cedric Allen Hills. If Brian Wilson and David Bowie had a child, it would be Cedric Allen Hills, right? I mean, this kid is a musical genius. Then I have Tony Daniels on guitar, who's a world-class guitar player, and a lovely actor-singer named Danny McGovern to put the vocal on the top. So we do a lot of 60s-type harmonies, you know, and it's very enjoyable music to listen to. And people really seem to like it, and it's very uplifting, you know, and fun.
Yeah. Cathartic as well. Well, that's coming up Thursday at the Colony. That's in Woodstock at 7. There's more information at colonywoodstock.com. Thomas Waits, I want to leave folks with a little bit of the music of Heartbreak Waits. I got Lines We Don't Cross teed up here, right? The latest track.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. That's a political one. Yeah.
Okay. Well, we'll get a little bit of taste of that. And Thomas Waits, thanks so much for joining us. All right.
I really appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
Shot another name, and once again they play the game. No pause to ask or mourn or learn, just point and blame and let it burn. Let it label pain to suit their side and use the grief to wound with pride.
Thomas Waits and the Heartbreak Waits. And you can get more information at thomasgwaits.com. Also, good time to remind you, our music auction is online right now. Bid now and support public radio. Support Radio Catskill at wjffradio.org. That's all for this edition of Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening.
Support comes from Catskills Property Care, offering full property care year-round for commercial and residential properties in Sullivan County, including snow plowing, landscaping, property checkups, and more. Information at CatskillsPropertyCare.com. And from the Calicoon Theater, an updated vintage movie theater with new film releases, live music, and more. CalicoonTheater.com. And from listeners like you, who donate at WJFFradio.org.
Has any company ever done anything like this before?
On the next Radiolab.
Honestly, there's nothing that even kind of comes close.
We meet members of Facebook's oversight board that'll judge the speech of billions of people.
80% of Facebook users are not American.
People are confused in the United States. This is just like childish play.
This is a very difficult task being done by people that have no freaking idea about our way of life.
That's on the next Radiolab. Wednesday afternoon at 2 on Radio Catskill.
This is WJFF Jeffersonville, streaming live at WJFFradio.org. Radio Catskill. Local news, culture, and NPR. Cloudy with some peaks of sunshine later on, a high 37, becoming more cloudy overnight, low 27. And tomorrow, cloudy early, maybe some sunshine in the afternoon, a high 42.